of Palestinians are injured as Israeli forces storm Al-Aqsa Mosque amid growing tensions in occupied Jerusalem and Al-Quds. Iran calls on the UN and other international bodies to confront Israeli violations in occupied Palestinian territories. And a bomb attack on a bus in southern Afghanistan leaves 11 people dead 2 days after blasts targeting a school in Kabul killed dozens of civilians. Welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Violent confrontations erupt in Al-Aqsa Mosque after Israeli forces stormed its courtyard amid escalating tensions in Jerusalem. The Palestinian Red Crescent says hundreds of people have suffered injuries after Israeli forces fired stun grenades to disperse Palestinian worshippers. The violence follows another night of clashes between the Israelis and Palestinians protesting Israel's planned evictions in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. 14 Palestinians were injured and 20 others arrested during the night clashes. Meanwhile, Palestinians held demonstrations in Ramallah and Gaza to denounce Israel's efforts for forcefully evicting Palestinians from their houses in Jerusalem Al-Quds. Our correspondent Mona Kendall says Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs has issued a statement urging the United Nations Security Council to protect Palestinians against Israeli atrocities.
The Palestinian paramedics in Jerusalem Al-Quds inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque, as well as Palestinian journalists, have been attacked by the Israeli forces, and they were ordered to leave the complex before we started this coverage. They ordered them to leave the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. The Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs just issued a statement urging the Security Council to ensure and to enable protection of the Palestinian people and to immediately stop the Israeli crimes, warning that if the Israelis continued their attacks, this would lead to another circle of clashes, and that could lead to a new uprising in Jerusalem Al-Quds.
Meanwhile, reactions are pouring in over violent clashes in Jerusalem Al-Quds sparked by Israel's attack on Al-Aqsa Mosque and its planned evictions of Palestinian families. The UN chief says Israel must exercise maximum restraint and respect the right of freedom of peaceful assembly. Antonio Guterres has urged Israel to cease demolitions and evictions. Iran has again expressed its solidarity with Palestinians, calling on the UN and other international bodies to confront Israeli violations. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh said the Islamic world needs to respond more than ever to Israeli brutality. Turkey has also warned that Israel bears the sole responsibility for any violence and called on Tel Aviv to stop attacking Palestinians and prevent settlers from entering Al-Aqsa Mosque. Commentator Mick Napier says the storming of Al-Aqsa Mosque sends a clear message of the ongoing ethnic cleansing against Palestinians.
This attack is sending a signal to people around the world that not even the Al-Aqsa Mosque is exempt from Israeli appetites. They don't want Palestinians there. They want a so-called Jewish temple there to replace the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And the pressure is relentless. This is the ethnic cleansing carried on without a break, but concentrated on the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The cruelty is transparent. And sad to say, the usual charade is beginning. There's condemnation of what Israel is doing. But these governments are not talking about action to make Israel stop.
Now, at least 11 people have died as a roadside bomb hit a bus in southern Afghanistan. A late-night explosion in Zabul province also left 28 people wounded, among them women and children. It is not immediately clear who was behind the blast. The bomb went off just hours before the Taliban militant group announced a three-day ceasefire on the occasion of Eid al-Fitr that marks the end of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. Violence has been on the rise in Afghanistan in recent weeks. On Saturday, a bomb explosion outside a school killed 85 people, many of them young girls. President Ashraf Ghani has declared national mourning on Tuesday for the victims of the Kabul blast.
Afghanistan is witnessing a new wave of violence that takes the lives of Afghans, including civilians, on a daily basis.
Dozens of civilians, most of them schoolgirls, died and many others were wounded in Kabul after a deadly car bomb followed by twin bomb explosions went off in front of a school. A similar assault also claimed the lives of 30 school students in eastern Logar province just a few days ago.
The blast occurred in front of a school in the Shia-majority neighborhood of Dasht-e-Barchi in western Kabul. The victims of the attack were mostly female students headed on their way back home after finishing school. Qurban Ali was in his shop when the incident happened. He says just after the blast, he rushed to the scene to look for her daughter, but almost after 10 hours, he found her daughter here in Kabul's emergency hospital for war victims.
I was in my shop when I heard a loud explosion. I rushed to the scene to look for my daughter, who is a student in a targeted school. A few moments later, twin blasts went off in the same area. There were too much casualties.
Afghan President Ashraf Ghani said the Taliban militant group was responsible for the attack. The Taliban, however, did not claim responsibility for the blast. The bomb attack came a week after remaining U.S. forces began withdrawing from Afghanistan. Yeah. Nearly two decades of the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan has failed to quell violence and ensure security in the country. Many here believe that terrorist groups are taking their revenge of their recent hard defeats in battles across southern and northern parts of the country. Kabul has witnessed several deadly terrorist attacks on civilian targets, mainly on educational centers, over the recent years. The recent attack on a high school there has brought vast condemnations by locals, the government, a number of independent rights bodies, and some Kabul-based foreign embassies, including Iranian embassy. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
India's daily coronavirus cases and fatalities have slightly retreated after hitting record peaks over the past several days. The health ministry reported more than 366,000 infections and over 3,700 deaths in the past 24 hours. The new fatalities have taken the overall tally to over 246,000. Infection cases now stand at over 22.6 million. The world's second most populous nation is spiraling deeper into the COVID-19 crisis since last month after a new highly infectious variant was detected there. A second wave has forced most Indian states to impose complete shutdowns. The country currently has over 3.6 million active cases, with hospitals in major cities facing shortages of equipment and oxygen. The federal government is reluctant to declare a national lockdown over fear of its impact on the economy. The raging coronavirus pandemic in India has raised concerns about the health of Kashmiri political prisoners in Indian-run jails. Families of the prisoners say they are not getting the medical attention that they need. Family members want the immediate release of their loved ones. Our correspondent in Indian-administered Kashmir, Shahana Butt, has the details.
The Indian-administered Kashmir witnessed the death of one of its prominent pro-freedom leaders in an Indian-run jail this week. Ashraf Zahrai's death has raised concerns about the scores of political prisoners languishing in Indian prisons as the country combats a fresh surge in coronavirus cases and deaths. That's amid testimonies by members of the 78-year-old's family, who said he died due to lack of health care and improper prison conditions after he tested positive for coronavirus. Now families of other political prisoners fear they could also face Sehrai's fate. The father of the 19-year-old Seher Shabir has spent 33 years of his life in different Indian detention centers. Shabir Shah is in prison for actively supporting Kashmir's right to self-determination. Sahar's father is among scores of Kashmiris who are imprisoned for supporting the region's independence from Indian rule. They are incarcerated under India's Public Safety Act, a preventive detention act that authorizes detention of any person for up to 3 months without a trial, and the detention period is extendable. Rights groups say the law has often been exploited to keep pro-independence supporters behind the bars. Human rights activist Ehsan Untu was also jailed recently. He says the central government has made it difficult to bail prisoners out.
The treatment of Kashmiri political prisoners in India is unfair. We are often kept with the criminals and are denied basic health care and medical attention. The entire setup is against Kashmiri prisoners. Even courts do not hold fair hearings. The international community must take action. Otherwise, no Kashmiri will walk alive from Indian jails.
Due to the raging pandemic last year, India's top court handed the decision to release prisoners on interim bail to the powerful state committees. Around 45,000 prisoners were released under the guidelines. However, not many of them were from among Kashmiri political prisoners. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
U.S. President Joe Biden says his COVID relief package worth nearly $2 trillion is helping economy recover from the pandemic. However, a monthly report by the Labor Department says U.S. employers only added 266,000 jobs in April. Economists have described the figure as a huge disappointment, as it was far from what was expected, which was 1 million new jobs.
Coronavirus pandemic has struck a heavy blow against major economies across the globe. Many people have lost their jobs or seen their income cut. However, development of vaccines was a breakthrough. Countries across the globe launched vaccination programs in order to reverse this negative trend and help their economies recover. Yet things have not worked out well for the world's largest economy, the U.S. According to the latest monthly employment report by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, the U.S. economy gained only 266,000 jobs last month. That is while economists had expected the number to top 1 million. Also, the unemployment rate rose to 6.1% amid an increasing shortage of available workers. But there were more bad news, as March's originally estimated 916,000 job gains were revised down to 770,000. Vaccination efforts and the relaxing of lockdown measures across the U.S. were expected to result in steady job growth. Yet the disappointing report is a surprise setback for U.S. President Joe Biden's efforts to revive America's economy from the coronavirus pandemic conundrum.
We came to office. We knew we were facing a once-in-a-century pandemic and a once-in-a-generation economic crisis. And we knew this wouldn't be a sprint. It'd be a marathon.
The April data shows the U.S. economy still has 8.2 million fewer jobs than it had in February of 2020, before the pandemic hit.
We're still digging out of an economic collapse that cost us 22 million jobs. Let me say that again. It cost us 22 million jobs. When we came in, we inherited a year of profound economic crisis and mismanagement on the virus.
Biden claims his $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief package is helping the U.S. economy to recover and is also pushing for another $4 trillion to be spent on infrastructure, education, and other priorities. However, his critics object to the high price tag and are warning that that could bring inflation. Moreover, Republicans and business groups have raised concerns about a disincentive for people to return to their jobs.
The reality was 75% less than what they had predicted. So it's a huge shortfall. I believe the economy is much weaker. I believe all the talk about a super powerful recovery was overdone. I think the economy is really struggling with the after effects of the pandemic. It's listless, it's weak, there are huge financial problems.
The U.S. economy is in a flux. On the one hand, there is a weak jobs report at the time when there are jobs out there, but they're not being filled. Some economists attribute to that to President Biden's initiatives. On the other hand, the government's huge spending is causing concern. The There is almost $2 trillion COVID stimulus relief. Then there is Biden's infrastructure plans to come in at $4 trillion. Now, the question is, how will all of this be paid?
The U.S. Labor Department's monthly report fell significantly short of expectations. While economists predicted that the economy would add about 1 million jobs, the report was a huge disappointment. Economists attribute the disappointing results to a range of issues, including safety concerns, child care issues, as well as extended unemployment benefits. In addition, according to government surveys, the number of unemployed workers is way higher than job openings. Also, there have not been any meaningful wage increases either, which are a hallmark of labor shortage.
There's a lot of speculation as to why. The Republicans, the conservatives blame it on over-generous unemployment benefits. I'm very skeptical. I think those jobs do not pay very well. I think if wages were higher, workers would be quicker to sign on. But as things stand now, the wages are so low that it may be more worth their while to stay at home and take care of the kids.
Unemployment rates for black and Latino women remained high. That is why women are being employed at lower rates in the U.S. Meanwhile, the hard-hit hospitality sector, which includes restaurants and hotels, and also manufacturing sectors, are unable to fill their job openings. That is why the unemployment rate is at high levels. Many unemployed Americans are reluctant to look for jobs because they fear catching the coronavirus. Others have entered new occupations and have left their old jobs. Moreover, many women, working mothers in particular, have left the workforce to care for children. Republicans and critics blame the Biden administration's policies for the slow economic recovery.
Well, that's what the Republicans complain. They want to see unemployment benefits cut because they want to force workers to go back to work. But it's very hard to tell. The wages have fallen very low, and workers have a lot of responsibilities at home.
The latest report reveals that the U.S. economy still has a long way to go to recover from the coronavirus pandemic.
With that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
People who limit the Quran to worshipping and personal matters haven't understood it. This is a part of a speech delivered on April 14, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, at the annual Ramadan Quranic meeting. The speech was delivered via video conference with the participation of a number of prominent Quranic reciters.
Whenever we refer to the Quran for a similar incident and whenever we ask for its guidance, the Holy Quran will offer us this particular guidance. Today is the same. In the present time too, some people might spread a rumor among us saying, such and such a government group and superpower is hatching plots against you. You are ruined, and other such rumors. Here too, the same guidance will be offered, but it only increased their faith. They said, for us Allah suffices, and He is the best disposer of affairs. Of course, for us, Allah suffices, and He is the best disposer of affairs. Cannot come true by sitting idle in a corner of one's house. We should come to the middle of the arena, as was the case with Muslims in that era. This is the lesson. Go to the heart of the arena and do what is necessary, and then say, for us, Allah suffices, and He is the best disposer of affairs. Fudayl ibn Yasir, an outstanding and trustworthy follower of Hazrat Baqir and Hazrat Sadiq, greetings be upon them, says that he once asked Imam Baqir alayhi salam what a specific narration meant. There was one specific narration which says, all ayahs in the Quran have an explicit and implicit meaning. Of course, the narration is longer than this. He asked what the explicit and implicit meanings are. Hazrat Baqir alayhi salam said, its implicit meaning is its ta'wil. Ta'wil means what an ayah refers or returns to. Some of the events have already happened and some have not taken place yet, and they will happen later. Like the sun and the moon, they will always be there. These holy ayahs are like the sun and the moon, which always stand above us. It is not the case that they are present in certain days and absent in certain others. They are always present. Quranic guidance is like this.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
The remaining signatories to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal have been meeting in the Austrian capital, Vienna, in recent weeks to find a way to salvage the international accord. While few details about the talks have been revealed, Press TV has learned that the US and the European signatories to the deal apparently want the destruction of Iran's new generation centrifuges in return for a temporary suspension of some of the sanctions related to the nuclear deal, officially titled the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. This is while, under the JCPOA, Iran's advanced centrifuges, including IR-4, IR-6, and IR-9s, must be stored away under the supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency and not destroyed. Press TV obtained information that shows Iran won't give in to the excessive demands of the Westerners, and also in case of insistence on the part of the other side, the possibility of the JCPOA, and not just the negotiations in Vienna, unraveling altogether will be real.
The Iranians have seen what the Americans and the Europeans have done. They've talked and talked and talked a lot about how they want the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action to succeed, and yet they've done everything in their power to ensure that it won't succeed. The Europeans refuse to permit trade with Iran in any kind of barter arrangement, even with that INSTEX, that International Exchange Program. So they're simply kowtowing to the Americans, acting as their running dogs, and simply making a big production out of nothing. It's a simple matter to abolish the sanctions and rejoin the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. But, of course, they won't do that, and they want to blame the Iranians for their own failures.
The new demands, meant to impose new nuclear commitments on Iran, have been put forward while the U.S. has not even agreed to remove all the JCPOA-related sanctions, a condition set by Tehran for a possible U.S. return to the nuclear deal. U.S. President Joe Biden has expressed his willingness to reverse Trump's policy regarding the JCPOA and to rejoin the deal. However, his administration has so far refused to take any meaningful action to gain Iran's trust and come back to compliance. External influences may have been a contributing factor. The U.S. president has reportedly met with the head of the Israeli regime's intelligence service, Mossad, in Washington, D.C. last week and told him his country isn't close to returning to the Iran nuclear deal. Biden reportedly said the United States has a long way to go in talks with Iran before it agrees to return to full compliance, comments that appear to have been assurances to Israel, which is a vehement opponent of the deal. The Mossad chief also reportedly asked Biden not to rejoin the accord without improving it first.
Well, Yossi Cohen, meeting with Jack Sullivan, Biden's national security advisor in Washington, with Biden just happening, mind you, happening to drop by the talks, is a clear indication that it's outside pressure and it's aimed at making inside demands and inside controls on the American government by the Israelis to reject and ditch the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The Israelis are probably afraid that someone might ask questions about why the JCPOA applies only to Iran and why isn't there not one that applies to Israel, India, and Pakistan, other nuclear states, with a very unstable track record. So I think that it is pressure from the inside, pressure under the table, if not subterranean.
Iran says the ball is in the U.S.'s court to return to the agreement and remove all its sanctions on Tehran, or pursue the failed policy of its predecessor, known as Maximum Pressure Campaign, and push ahead with its hostile policy against the Islamic Republic.
Israel's occupation of Palestine and the plight of Palestinians have once again come into focus globally as people worldwide mark the International Quds Day. Every year, on the last Friday of the fasting month of Ramadan, pro-Palestinian groups from all faiths show solidarity with those affected by the occupation. The issue of Palestine is today recognized as one of the most complicated crises that seems far from any kind of resolution. But when did it all begin? The mass displacement of Palestinians from their ancestral lands mainly dates back to May 14, 1948, when Israel was created in Palestine and immediately recognized by the United States. Palestine had been under British colonial control until May that year. Britain had long encouraged Zionist Jews to come to Palestine. The 1948 Declaration of Independence is widely considered as the starting point for an occupation that has triggered many wars and impacted the whole Middle East and the world. Soon after the creation of Israel, the forced displacement of Palestinians, known as the Nakba, or catastrophe, began. Several hundred Palestinian villages were razed to the ground, and their residents were forced to flee and were never allowed to return. Today, the refugees and their descendants around the world number 5 million. Israel has been seizing more Palestinian lands over the past decades and keeps building on them. What's now left for the Palestinians is a tiny fraction of their original homeland. This map shows how Palestinian territories have been shrinking over the past decades. The Israeli violations of Palestinians' rights are many. To Israeli authorities, Palestinian lives don't matter at all. The Israeli regime does not hesitate to kill. Meanwhile, the regime has engaged in demographic engineering, discrimination in access to education, healthcare, and building rights. Just days ago, leading international rights group Human Rights Watch issued a report condemning Israel for committing the crimes of apartheid and persecution against Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territories. In 2017, the UN Economic and Social Commission for Western Asia issued a damning report on Israeli practices in occupied Palestinian territories. The report said Israel has established an apartheid regime that oppresses the Palestinians as a whole. But for Israel, such reports and repeated UN resolutions are no big concern, as the regime has full US diplomatic cover. Meanwhile, Palestinians have been let down by some Arab states. Last year, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Sudan recognized Israel and normalized their ties with the regime. Palestinians are outraged by the normalization, which they believe is threatening their planned statehood. Palestinians say those Arab states are stabbing them in the back. Palestinians know all too well that their options are very limited at the moment. As many governments refuse to pressure the Israeli regime, it is hoped that resistance and popular grassroots campaigns against Israel will one day change things for the better.
Raising awareness, circulating these things on social media, holding your politicians accountable, also bring the campaign aid, I mean, help people in Palestine. You know, everybody can reach out to somebody in Palestine and let them videotape the scenario around them. Like, you know, Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, we always have campaign aids in Gaza. And, you know, when they get us video coverage of the houses inside and how they're living in their neighborhoods, this already by itself shows how this blockade and this occupation has treated these people and what status they're at right now. They're living in poverty. They're living in the worst conditions. And this is because of the occupation, nothing else.
American politician and lawyer Elliot Abrams, who has served in a number of U.S. administrations, has proposed to improve American foreign policy. In an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, Abrams argued that the U.S. is at a critical crossroads when it comes to the defense of American freedom, security, and prosperity. Abrams says around the world, the U.S. faces significant national security threats, among them revisionist powers, the spread of nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons, and transnational terrorism, which are all made more dangerous by renewed great power competition with China. Abrams believed none of those challenges will disappear if America abandons the international role it has maintained since World War II as what he called a superpower leader of the free world. Abrams also says that is why he is joining with 75 other national security scholars and practitioners to launch the Vandenberg Coalition, a new network committed to advancing what has been described as a strong and proud American foreign policy. But what is this war party and what purpose does it serve?
We will eliminate all of these people with this dual loyalty, like Elliot Abrams. Elliot Abrams is the son of Norman Podaritz, a son-in-law of Norman Podaritz and Mitch Decter, a classic neocon, a man who's willing to break the laws of the United States of America in the interest of Israel. He had to get a pardon in order to get his job, his security clearance. We need to have a clear dividing line here between the people who serve Israel, like Elliot Abrams, who serve Israel's interests, and the people who serve America's interests.
Many believe this sounds more like the project for the new American century. PNAC, which was active between the years of 1997 and 2006, was a new conservative think tank whose goal was to promote American global leadership. The group openly advocated for total global military domination, and many PNAC members held highest level positions in the George W. Bush administration.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. Nothing has changed except the labels. These people were, for some reason they didn't like Donald Trump. I don't understand this. He did everything that Israel wanted. But this, the problem here is that these people are always using front groups. They're always trying to disguise themselves as an American this or Republican that or conservative this. All of these labels are covers. They're disguises for the fact that these are Jews pursuing Jewish interests, with this interest of the state of Israel and not the interest of the United States of America.
Elliot Abrams' proposal comes as the United States has already been actively engaged in multiple confrontations in the Middle East and East Asia. It's now a decades-long war on countries like Afghanistan and Iraq, and even Syria have led to nothing but deaths and destruction. The wars cost America trillions of dollars. However, numerous military manufacturers, including Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, and Northrop Grumman, have large contributions to U.S. wars by profiting the most from them. This is why growing arms investments mean a lot for international relations. Many believe this may be the reason behind the creation of the project suggested by Abrams. Meanwhile, Washington has been at a trade war with China for some years. It has also been initiating a potential altercation by keeping its presence in the South China Sea and other areas in the region. It seems that such comments by the likes of Abrams only serve the U.S. military manufacturers and the deep state, which support forever wars, as opposed to the policy of the new administration of President Joe Biden.
But if you're talking about America's interest, you're disguising once again the fact that this is Israel's interest. These are Jewish interests. And yeah, there is a military-industrial complex that profits from wars. That's true. But that all disguises the fact that what Elliot Abrams really represented here. So as I said at the beginning, I think this is a good idea. I think they should form a Jewish party. If you want Jewish interests, if you want America to serve Jewish interests, then vote for Elliot Abrams and all of his formerly known as neoconservative friends.
Biden's reluctance to continue down the path of neocons and other warmongers in the U.S. ruling establishment aside, the U.S. is practically unable to keep going down that road. On the other hand, multiple U.S. wars waged over the past decades indicate that the United States is a warning power, as it has not won any of them. Yet Washington wants to continue its wars and its costs. Most observers, strategists, and political scientists, as well as sitting and former officials in the U.S. and the wider West, believe that America's clout has long been under decline and the country is no longer capable of acting like the good cop it has portrayed itself to be.
New allegations are swirling around British Prime Minister Boris Johnson about misusing funds received from Conservative Party donations. The Prime Minister stands accused of infringing the law by using the funds to renovate his residence at No. 11 Downing Street. The allegation has prompted an Electoral Commission probe into the matter, which can take months to complete. Johnson maintains that he has personally paid for the costs of the renovation.
Who initially, and Prime Minister, initially is the key word here, who initially paid for the redecoration of his Downing Street flat?
As for the latest stuff that he's bringing up, he should know that I've paid for Downing Street refurbishment personally, Mr. Speaker, and I contrast it any further declaration that I have to make, I will, I will be advised upon by Lord Guy.
However, the British Prime Minister did not clarify whether he initially made the payments.
Well, if any of the three reviews into his conduct find that he broke the ministerial code, then Johnson would be expected to resign, but just expected. is how it says. But the code has already proved useless, really, like in the case of Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon. She did a lot worse. But really, I don't think the Electoral Commission, which is investigating it, is conducting at least one of the investigations, will really want to bring down the leader of an elected government with a large majority.
The latest allegation, which is referred to by the British media as the sleaze row, comes only days before local elections across the country are scheduled to be held. A recent opinion poll now shows the ruling Conservatives are losing their lead over the opposition Labour Party. Apart from the redecoration scandal, there have been other unconfirmed reports that the Conservative Party donors have been solicited funds for personal matters. The Sunday Times has cited a British MP as saying that he had received a complaint from a donor who was asked to pay for Boris Johnson's child's nanny. A spokesperson for the Prime Minister's office dismissed the report, saying Johnson had paid all the childcare costs himself, but she didn't respond to a question about who had initially made the payment. But that's not the only report tarnishing the Prime Minister's image. He's recently been grilled about whether or not he had said he would rather see bodies piled up in their thousands than declare another nationwide lockdown. Remarks he flatly rejects ever making.
Prime Minister.
No, Mr. Speaker, and I think what I think the Right Honourable Gentleman is a lawyer, I'm given to understand. I think that if he's going to repeat allegations like that, he should come to this House and substantiate those allegations and say where he heard them and who exactly is supposed to have said those. Who exactly is supposed to have said those things, Mr. Speaker? Because what I certainly can tell him. And he asked about the October decisions. They were very bitter.
The rules on parliamentarians' expenses were really tightened up more than 10 years ago, and a few MPs were forced to resign over that. But that means that a lot of the Westminster sleaze that we used to talk about all the time has been eliminated. I think the reason that this has become such a big issue is that the Labour Party opposition doesn't have any clear policies or even really broad politics.
Tories are now debating who's behind the leaks, with the majority of fingers now pointing at former aide to the Prime Minister, Dominic Cummins. In the meantime, the opposition Labour Party has accused the government of showing contempt against the British people by engaging in such infightings.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Axel Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatih al-Jinan, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. Alhamdulillah, we're making some good progress in reading from this book and sharing with you some of the vital points that Ayatollah Sheikh Jawadi Amuli makes. And inshallah, we will all be able to benefit as much as we can. We're still on the topic of how a person deals with their kin. And at the moment, we're talking about your immediate kin. So we spoke about parents, and now we're going to speak about children. The Islamic way of looking at children is they are like an amana. They have been entrusted to us. We need to make sure that we pay attention to their health, we pay attention to the environment that they are going to grow up in, we pay attention to their education, and we pay attention to their tarbiyah, to their upbringing. You read the hadith that say that for example, that a sufra, a table spread of food that doesn't have in it a child whose name is Ahmed or Muhammad or this or that, is one that is void of blessings from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. These are, you know, very, very important kind of pointers that we need to always remember. But there are huquq, there are certain rights, you know, that a parent must observe in favor of his or her child. And yuhsin ismah. This is something that is very frequently mentioned as well, that you make sure that you choose a nice name, a good name. Anyway, the first thing that is mentioned after all of this is child's welfare. How do we tend to a child's welfare? Well, first of all, we need to make sure that the household is stable, that the husband-wife relationship is a healthy relationship, that it's not toxic, that it's not full of tension, that it's not going to transfer negative vibe to the children. Even if the child is a baby, an infant, breastfeeding child, it's still going to pick up on all of that toxicity that is in the household if there are problems and ongoing issues and things like that. We always need to be extremely careful about that. And even when you look at the riwayat from Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, the very first thing that Ayatollah Jawadi mentions is the sexual awareness of children. But this is in reference to the parents, where parents need to be aware of how vulnerable, similar to a sponge, a child is, where they are going to absorb everything emotionally, spiritually, morally, socially, religiously. This is why Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he says in this hadith that la yujami'u ar-rajulu imra'atahu, that a husband should not have intimacy with his wife, وَفِي الْبَيْتِ صَبِيٌّ, while there is a child in the house. Well, here it says bait, but our understanding is in the bedroom.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, the author of the book مفاتيح الحیات, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.,
یه جلدش کم داره و اون اینه که فرون درخت کاری اینجا کم سواب داره دعا هم داره سواب هم داره.
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام اونطوری که اینو گفته بودم گفته دی اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری سواب داره همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری اون سواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Husband and wife, their privacy is for them. When they want to have their sexual intimacy, when they want to have their time alone, they are more than entitled to have that, not with a child in the in their bedroom. A child needs to be in another bedroom. A child needs to be somewhere else while they are having their time alone. And Islamically, this is one of the most condemned things for a husband and a wife or for a parent to do. So the child's cot should never be in the same bedroom as the parents. Alhamdulillah, one of the good things is we can see that many people, you know, have beds for their or bedrooms for their children, you know, but sometimes, unfortunately, some parents give in because the child is always crying and things like that, and they give in to the child, and then the child becomes so accustomed to sleeping with the mother, with the father, that, you know, it just destroys the parents' private life. That being said, we understand that there are a lot of things that are also related to what we call child sex education, or sex education for children, or sexual welfare, if we could use that kind of expression, where, you know, we teach our children from a very young age what private parts mean and how you are not allowed to show or expose your private parts to anybody, even your own parents, even your own siblings. You can't. Of course, this is going to be something fundamental in a child's life, where he or she, they grow up and they know that absolutely nobody is allowed to see them naked or anything like that. So this is going to make them more aware of their rights as children, so that, God forbid, they don't have any kind of, for example, traumatizing incident by, nastajiru billah, any kind of sexual offenses from other people. Walhamdulillahi rabbil alameen, wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahireen.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams. Hear the children's cries.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
Economic divide. welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kovit Atlay. Hope you're doing fine. Of course, that greeting was usually answered by I'm fine. But in the era of COVID-19, one is afraid to ask, worried that someone has actually gotten COVID, or worse yet, someone that they know has passed away. Nevertheless, COVID-19 is the subject of today's program, in particular, hoarding by G7 rich nations and how it hurts their economies. Okay, coming up in today's program, we are going to take a look at why the world's wealthiest countries are getting vaccinated 25 times faster. Why is that happening? Obviously a big concern. Next, we will look at which countries are guilty of what's called vaccine nationalism and vaccine hoarding. Is your country one of them? And then we're going to take a look at this whopping figure, $9.2 trillion, the global economy. That's how much money it stands to lose if governments fail to ensure developing economy access to COVID-19 vaccines. Okay, let's face it. We have failed when it comes to the pandemic called COVID-19 or coronavirus. You don't need to take my word for it. The stats speak for themselves. First, the world's wealthiest countries are getting vaccinated 25 times faster. That means that enough vaccines have been administered to fully vaccinate just about 5% of the global population. But the distribution has been lopsided. Most vaccines are going to the wealthiest countries. Now, if that doesn't sink in, then let's take a look at this stat. So far, 40% of the COVID-19 vaccines administered globally have gone to people in just 27 wealthy nations. That represents only 11% of the global population. And that has raised the alarm, all the way to the UN, who has voiced concern over the matter.
Vaccine nationalism is an economic as well as a moral failure.
Antonio Guterres, the UN Secretary General. Now, remember this figure that we ran in our headlines? We're going to take a look at it one more time. It's the cost of vaccine hoarding. This figure right here, $9.2 trillion. Big number. Well, let's go back to Guterres and see what he has to say about that.
And the latest research by the International Chamber of Commerce shows that without support to the developing world, this crisis could cost the global economy up to $9.2 trillion, and almost half, including in the wealthiest countries. And that figure is 340 times more than the $27 billion funding gap that we have now in the ACT Accelerator, our best tool to make vaccines available to everyone, everywhere, and speed up a global recovery. While every country has the right and the duty to protect its own people, no country can afford to neglect the rest of the world.
Antonio Guterres there. Can the situation get any bleaker than that? Unfortunately, the answer is yes. Now, the picture that you see here is Andrea Taylor. She is a Duke University researcher who has analyzed vaccine purchases. She actually has made some startling revelations, which breaks open the shocking reality that the world is facing when it comes to vaccines. For example, she has said that rich countries actually have what's called priority manufacturing. Now, what does that mean? That means that even if other countries make purchases now, they may have to wait months or maybe even a year for the delivery of the vaccines to happen. So, what happens as a result? Well, according to her research, high-income countries have 16% of the world's population. Currently, they hold 60% of the vaccine doses that have been purchased. That is what's alarming about the research that she has done. Let's hear what she has to say about that.
Unfortunately, what our research is making clear is that the direct deals that these countries are negotiating may also at the same time be undermining their investment in equity by reducing the number of doses that will be available in the first year or two.
All right. Well, let's bring in our guest to explain to us how bad vaccine hoarding by rich countries is jeopardizing the economic well-being of other countries, including themselves. Martin Summers is a citizen journalist and works at Bristol Community Radio. He's also active in Bristol West Labour Party, Bristol Stop the War, and the Columbia Solidarity Campaign. Martin, welcome. The stats are alarming based on what we're covering here in this program. 10 countries accounting for 3/4 of the 191 million COVID-19 vaccinations that were given through mid-February, a sign that the race to vaccinate the world is hardly on even footing. And if wealthy nations, they don't act quickly, a more equitable allocation of vaccines to be the goal, it's a race everyone could lose. How can anything justify this inequality?
Well, the short answer is nothing can justify it. But as you know,
the world is a very divided place, and the powerful are able to pull strings to get